welcome to EXO 101, Introduction to Exobiology. Good afternoon. Today we're going to have our second lecture. This is EXO 101, Introduction to Exobiology. I apologize if my voice sounds a little odd. I'm getting over a cold, but I'm sure we'll be able to get through this just fine. So, last time we talked about different biomes, that is, different environments in which living things can be found, with special notes for biomes which are producing sentient life. Today we are going to be covering genetic materials. These are the means by which life perpetuates itself, and as such are quite important for understanding biology, regardless of what planet it's on. So, what is a genetic material? At its base, a genetic material is how information is passed down to the next generation of organisms. This doesn't necessarily, and I should point out, from cell to cell. So within your own body, as you grow and your cells die and are replaced, we need ways of passing information down to those descendant cells, known as daughter cells, to make sure they know who they are and what they're supposed to do. So it contains instructions for making proteins, which for all sentient life that we've found so far are the building blocks of our bodies. Building a body, getting those cells, those proteins to assemble into cells, to grow the correct structures, to arrange the cells in the right orientation, all of that. For cell-cell communication, the instructions that are in the genetic material tell the cells how to respond to signals that they hear, when to send out signals of their own. And this coordination is what's needed for multicellular life to occur. It also contains instructions for responding to environmental cues. A cell needs to know what is it supposed to do if the temperature changes, if it encounters a particular chemical, if water starts to run dry, or if there's too much. All of that is held within the genetic material. So we're going to be focusing on molecular material here. As we know, the information can be inherited from other forms. Artificial intelligence, should it exist, would obviously use a different format for passing information from one individual onto its descendants. The K6 use data inheritance, which is manifested in the structure of the crystalline parts of their brains. But we're going to be focusing on molecular material. So for a molecular material, or any material, to make a good genetic material, it has to have a few common characteristics. It has to be stable, but still mutable. You don't want it to be so stable that the organisms can't evolve. If genetic material is completely static, when the environment shifts, if a new disease arises, if new predators are available, if the food sources change, if the weather patterns change, they're stuck. They're either all going to live or all going to die. So species which are very slow to evolve are not great at handling changes in their environment. On the other side, you do not want the genetic material to be too unstable. You do not want to have wild mutations from generation to generation. If it is not able to maintain enough stability for a life form to maintain integrity, it's not going to be successful. It also needs to be able to encode information. So it has to be in a compact form. You have to keep in mind that for a human cell, there are 2 meters, or 6 feet for those using archaic measurements, 2 meters of DNA per cell. That's taller than an average human. And yet it has to fit inside each nucleus of every single cell, and there are 30,000 genes encoded in that genetic material, all packed inside the nucleus of each cell. And this is with a surprisingly large amount of what we refer to as junk DNA, big spaces between the relevant parts. It appears that this is actually protective for the human genome. It allows many mutations to fall in areas which do not damage critical genes. making the genome more stable. Considering the odd inbred history of humanity, maybe this is a way that we adapted to that challenge. So you have to encode information in a compact form. It has to be easy to retrieve. Your cell needs to be able to respond to the environment very quickly. It can't spend hours and hours trying to sort through its genetic information to find the relevant instruction. And being able to record multiple forms of information is a plus. For example, on Earth, we find that DNA is able to encode for RNA. Many of those RNAs encode for proteins, but some of those RNAs have functions of their own. So the DNA is encoding for information both in terms of what proteins to make and which functional RNAs to make. So this gives a more efficient way of encoding information. You're basically doing more than one thing at once. The genetic material also needs to be copied. If you have a cell that has all the information it could ever want, but it has no way of copying this information and passing it on, that's a dead end. It's not going to be evolutionarily successful. We're not going to see its descendants present. So we need a way of copying this information and copying it reliably in a stable fashion so that, for example, with multicellular life, those of us who are clonal, our cells all have the same DNA, that DNA needs to be copied over and over and over again, billions of times, and without significant mutations. If we do have mutations, you end up with things like cancers, aberrant growths. In mild cases, you could end up with forms of chimerism, basically a mosaicism would be a better term. A chimera is when you have an individual who's a merging of two different genotypes, so the Akani are natural chimeras. Mosaicism is when the cell types have a common origin but have diverged. So mosaicism is a better term for that. So copying genetic material allows for multicellular life. You could have that theoretical perfect cell with uncopyable genetic material, or if some other form of life, if it wasn't a cell. It's never going to be able to obtain the kind of complexity we have with multicellular life if it can't copy itself. And the copying must be fast and reliable, but like I mentioned before, not too reliable. We want to be able to have the genetic material evolve. Sometimes those mutations are harmful. Most of the time, they're neutral. But every now and then, you get that next great adaptation that allows the species to survive an upcoming challenge, to take a leap forward. This is the stuff that survival and evolution is made out of. Okay, so let's talk about some known genetic materials. For the most of what we now are aware of, we have a common primary structure. We have a sugar phosphate backbone. In Earth case, with the sugar backbone is a ribose or a deoxyribose. Other sugars have been found in other planets, as I'm sure you're aware. There is a phosphate, generally, that is used for polymerization. Phosphates are great at chemical reactions. They are what's used to bind each base of the genetic backbone to the next one. And in most cases, we use a nitrogenous base for the base pairing. This is where the information lies. The backbone provides a structure on which the series of nitrogenous bases can be held, referenced, copied. But the actual information is in which order do we use the bases. On Earth, we have the GATC. Other ones are absolutely possible and are found in other species. The higher order structures, these we frequently see a double helix. These are complementary strands of nucleic acids where one strand is able to base pair with the other. So the nitrogenous bases line up in a way where they fit together. So the A and the T and the C and the G have structures where they're able to pair with each other using hydrogen bonds. And these are stable enough to hold the two strands together. It gives it a lot of stability that we don't have in a single-stranded form, but it's still able to be pulled apart so that the sequence can be accessed to be read or copied. These strands are anti-parallel. Because of the way the phosphate works, for any single strand of nucleic acid, you have asymmetrical ends. On Earth, we have a 5' prime and a 3' prime end. The locations are named based on the structure of the sugar that is part of the backbone. So on Earth, when we're using ribose and deoxyribose, we have a 5' prime and a 3' prime end. Other planets have their own structures. So the terminology is going to vary somewhat depending on which planet we're talking about, but we see overall similarities. Double helixes are fairly common. It's a nice way to record information. It's nice and stable, and is also quite flexible and compactable. You can use this to compact a lot of DNA into a small space. We can also use single-stranded structures. RNA, for example, is frequently single-stranded and can take on highly complex shapes, which can give it enzyme activity. So you can have a molecule that encodes information and also carries out enzymatic activity. Remember, I mentioned that DNA can code for RNA that has its own function aside from encoding for protein. So you can have organisms which have this as part of their genome. So I've mentioned mutations a few times. I would like to talk a little bit more about them. Most mutations stem from errors in replication. Given the size of the genomes for most organisms, even a very low rate of replication error can cause the occasional mismatch. So this is frequently mismatches in base pairing. The enzyme that's adding the bases, called a polymerase, is supposed to add a particular base. It adds the wrong one, and it's not caught. Most errors are corrected, so that's why we don't just mutate wildly into giant tumors, and that's the end of it. But every now and then, some errors do slip through. Sometimes mutations are deliberate. For the example, the Akani have the ability to self-edit their DNA, giving them the ability to create whatever proteins they may need, enzymes to meet whatever their environment throws at them. It's thought that they evolved this ability due to their hyperstable DNA. They originally evolved to be too stable, and the information we have, because remember, early Akani history is not very well recorded. It appears that that was done deliberately, that the early Akani recognized mutation as a threat. They felt that with their level of intelligence, they no longer needed mutations to adapt to their environment, so they basically engineered themselves to have perfect DNA polymerases. They no longer needed mutations. Except then they realized that, oh no, wait, they do need mutations. Sometimes they needed to come up with a new molecular approach to an environmental challenge. So they gave themselves the ability, they developed the ability to self-edit. So they can basically make their own mutations. And some Akani are known to practice what would be the equivalent of human body modification. Introduce some random mutations and see what happens. This doesn't always go well, but it can produce some very interesting results. The humans have a history of genetic engineering. I mentioned that humans inbred past. We as a species nearly died out. There was a mega drought. We got down to somewhere between 1,500 to 2,500 humans. All the humans that are alive today are descended from that small group, which means the family tree doesn't fork like it should. We are not great at reproducing. Left to its own devices, the human reproductive system will produce 75% of the embryos as non-viable. So basically 75% of conceptions do not produce viable offspring. And humans have put a lot of effort into trying to correct this. We've come up with a variety of different techniques for repairing diseases, basically mutations that were causing detrimental syndromes. And that was great. The problem is it became politically destabilizing. I'm sure you're all familiar with some of the less successful efforts in, quote-unquote, improving humanity, trying to engineer in traits that did not occur on their own, the segregation of those who considered themselves superior from everyone else. This kind of technology is only useful if it's available to everyone and if we have a fairly strict definition of what we consider a quote-unquote disease. preventing a cancer-causing syndrome, cool, get rid of that. Starting to alter how human consciousness works, probably not a fantastic idea, as we have seen from historical examples. There are quite likely others. A lot of species don't like to talk about that period in their history. Most species have hit that ability. Most of us make mistakes. Humans, as you know, have a weird tendency to talk about how we've screwed up. Other species may not be as forthcoming. The Akani, the reason we get along with the humans and the Akani get along, we have similar lack of shame on a lot of those issues. But it's thought that, for example, the Koromar may have used genetic engineering to create the lineage for their sovereign as a way of uniting their northern and southern populations, creating a ruler that would not be unacceptable to either group due to their innate xenophobic tendencies. A lot of mutations happen due to environmental insults. Radiation is a very common source of this. For species that need to live above ground, we have to deal with the sun. Our various solar exposures, depends on which planet you're on, we're going to have different levels of radiation, but we all have to deal with some. UV radiation can cross-link DNA bases, leading to breakage in the strand. We can end up with base substitutes. Some chemicals that we're exposed to will simulate one or another of the bases and can insert themselves into our genetic code, causing a problem the next time that DNA is replicated. We can also have mutations caused by viruses. Those of you who have taken medical history may remember cervical cancer, where humans had a cancer that was caused by a communicable virus. And happily, that disease no longer exists. The vaccine was successful and it's been wiped out. But new viruses that have that kind of ability could pop up at any time. Biological weapons are, I've classified them as environmental insults. I guess you could also consider them a deliberate source of mutation. Weapons that are aimed at destroying a particular genetic sequence have unfortunately been used several times throughout the galaxy. It's part of why the Alliance exists, is to ensure that weapons like this do not get used again. We do need to acknowledge that this is a possible source of genetic mutation. And others do exist. There's a variety of different chemicals that can be exposed to that can damage our DNA. This is all going, or other nucleic acids. This is all going to vary by species. So how do we encode information? Most species use a codon system. This is where the bases are read as 3 to 4 base pair words. In the case of on Earth, we use 3. Other species use 4. Each corresponds to an amino acid for making proteins. And as you should have had in your introductory biology class, the vast, vast majority of life that we've discovered uses proteins as the basis for its biology. Those proteins can take on many, many different forms, use a huge variety of different nucleic acids. On Earth, we use 20. There are many more out there. So the number of different codons is going to vary by species, which amino acids they're using, how degenerate the code is varies by species. Here, degenerate is not a comment on its moral stature. It is talking about how redundant the code is. In the case of on Earth, we have several different codons that could code for the same amino acid, which means that if a mutation hits one of those codons, it doesn't necessarily alter the structure of the final protein that makes us more resilient to environmental insult to our DNA. Okay, epigenetic changes can alter how information is used within a genome. These are inheritable changes in DNA structure, which can alter gene expression. The DNA sequence itself is unchanged, but certain parts of it may be turned off while others are active. A good example for this is in humans, females have 2X chromosomes, males have an X and a Y. This is strictly speaking about chromosomal sex and no other aspect of sexuality or gender. That's a different course. We might actually get to that a little bit later we will touch on that a little bit later in this class, but for now we're just talking about cellular sex. Since females have two copies of the X chromosome, to avoid getting double doses of all of those genes, they turn most of them off. So this allows them to basically modulate gene expression by inactivating that section of the DNA. In some cases, these changes can be inherited. There are patterns within genes that may be turned off to, again, modulate gene expression. And that state will be inherited in subsequent cells or even in subsequent generations. So this is a way of altering which information is being used. We also see information encoded in the structure of single-stranded nucleic acids. This enzyme activity that things like single-stranded RNA can have is determined by the sequence. So the sequence of base pairs determines the structure of that molecule, which determines its function. So again, we have information being used to generate a function within the cell. We also need to copy our nucleic acids. So copying or replication, same thing. For double-stranded nucleic acids, you first have to separate the strands. Then you make a second strand based on the sequence of the first. Remember, those strands are complementary. So we have now created two duplicates of the original sequence, each with one old strand and one new. An advantage of this technique means that if there is an error in making the new strand, the cell can usually tell which is the old strand and which is the new, and therefore can correct the new to match the old, another way of catching mistakes. In linear chromosomes, we use multiple origins of replication. Basically, you'll separate the DNA in multiple spots and start filling in the new strand, and these areas will eventually run into each other. This should be a review from Intro Bio 1, probably. For circular chromosomes, like we see in Earth's bacterial life forms or in the Akani, you can do rolling circle replication, where the DNA starts to be read at one point in the circle, and it is copied around and around and around. You can spin off many, many, many different copies of a piece of DNA using this method. If you're copying single-stranded DNA, it's a little more complicated. You need to make the complementary strand and then make a new copy of the original sequence. So you have strand one, you make strand two, which is complementary to strand one. You then separate those strands, make another strand that's complementary to strand two, which should be identical to the original strand one. So a lot of times you'll see even species that rely on single-stranded nucleic acid may keep a double-stranded storage copy in one part of the cell, in a nucleus, wherever, and then use that as a reference. It's thought that that may be actually the start of life forms like what we have on Earth, where we have the DNA in the nucleus and we've got RNA doing most of the heavy lifting. The DNA is basically just there to store information. It's not active. It is a passive subject of whatever proteins happen upon it. But the RNA is what actually carries out the actions within the cell. Okay, so the whole point of having genetic information that can be copied is so that you can pass it on. It can be inherited. So we're first going to start talking about mitosis, or asexual reproduction. Asexual reproduction is any time you have a new cell or new life form with only one parent. In this case, you have to copy your genetic material, replicate any other cellular components that are needed for the new daughter cell, divide all of that into two identical daughter cells. So this is used for somatic cells in most species. The Akani use this along with self-editing in order to reproduce. They will also accompany this with the exchange of plasmids. We'll talk about this later, through conjugation. Sexual reproduction relies on meiosis. Sexual reproduction is any time you have two parents for the new offspring, two or more parents. My human bias was showing there. In this case, you need to copy the genetic material and then divide it into the daughter cells, and each is going to get a subset of the original DNA. So if you have two parents, like we have on Earth, we have two-parent sexual reproduction, you'll have four daughter cells, with each having a half complement of the DNA. So when the two gametes reunite, they will recreate a full complement of the original genetic material. If you have four parents, you'll have eight daughter cells with one quarter of the original cells each, and so forth. Basically, you need what you need to do is reduce the amount of DNA in each gamete, each reproductive cell, so that after reproduction, you're back up to a full complement. You don't want to end up with extra chromosomes. You don't want to have any left out. Recombination is frequently a part of meiosis. This gives the ability to shuffle pieces of homologous chromosomes back and forth. So in the case of life on Earth, where sexually reproducing species have two parents, we have two of each chromosome. So the maternal and the paternal chromosome will line up during prophase, early on in the cell cycle, exchange pieces with each other, and nothing is gained or lost, but now some of the traits that were on one chromosome are on the other, and vice versa. So this is another way of getting genetic variation in your offspring without having to rely solely on mutations. Because remember, mutations are sometimes dangerous. New combinations of traits rarely are, because these were all functional traits to start with, as evidenced by the fact that you survived long enough to be doing this. Other forms of inheritance, viral transfection. A virus can infect a host and bring new DNA with it. We see this frequently in bacterial life on Earth. You can have the process of transformation. This is where a cell will pick up DNA from its environment. Bacterial cells on Earth can do this. The Akani have been known to do this on occasion. They generally don't because it's dangerous, but it is a possibility. You can also reproduce through conjugation. This is, as I mentioned, something the Akani do. In this case, two cells form a bridge between the two, a little tube of membrane, and they feed a copy of this DNA from one cell into the other. This is allows for that new cell to take on a new trait. And the Akani are known to do this to exchange useful pieces of DNA from one to the other, which allows them to adapt very rapidly to new situations. If one of them comes up with, say, a protein that is able to denature a toxin in their environment, they can pass the gene for that, pass the plasmid that's encoding that DNA to everyone around them, and they'll spread it to the others. And you basically can now give everyone the ability to deal with that toxin and become immune. So this is part of why the Akani have been so successful in terraforming planets, why they are well known for their skill in the chemical sciences. They have the ability to basically become chemical factories themselves. We also see Akanis practicing recombination. They will use conjugation to take part of their core genome, not just the plasmids that carry the supplemental genes, send a copy to another cell. That individual will then carry out recombination, like I mentioned before, swapping traits back and forth, and send that back. This is done when they need to update their core genome, which is done fairly rarely because at this point they've got it pretty much where they want it. But with new environments, they may need to do this to survive. Okay, so there are certain consequences that come along with inheritance. The need to pass on, because we don't live forever, if a species is going to survive, it needs to have a way of passing on its genetic information. This is just a side effect of how life works. So adaptive alleles. Alleles are versions of a gene. For example, humans all have genes that encode for molecules that will be on the surface of our blood cells. And we have different forms. There's type A, type B, and type O. A, B, and O are all different alleles that are caused by variations in the function of an enzyme for making that molecule. So adaptive alleles favor survival. Those that have them are able to survive in their environment better than those that don't. We also see this manifesting in the case of sibling altruism. I have it in quotes here on the slide because some people argue that it's not truly altruism because siblings share a good chunk of their genetic material. If you have two parents and assuming that each parent is passing on half its DNA, two full siblings will share 50% of their alleles on average. So if you help your sibling survive, if you help your sibling reproduce, if you keep your niblings alive, then a good chunk of the alleles that are present in you are now being passed on. So This renders relatives as something other than competitors. It is thought this may be the root of tendency towards family-based social units. It's no longer everyone for themselves. Helping your family members out not only helps keep you alive, it helps keep your genetic lineage going, which means the traits that favor a social structure are the ones successful ones and get passed on. It's thought the flip side of this could be xenophobic tendencies. It's well known that some species have an innate hostility towards those who do not share a sufficient amount of genetic material with them. They perceive them as threats, and that, you know, biggest example is the Koromar. They have, there's a reason that they keep them themselves. They know that they do not feel comfortable in society with other sentient beings. They tend to divide the world into competitors and food. And as anybody who's ever seen some of the history of the Koromar Wars, you don't want to be either of those two. So that's kind of the flip side of favoring family, favoring genetic relatives in terms of survival. The ease of inheritance also plays a role in how it shapes the life, shapes a life form. If passing on your traits is easy, for example, if you can make gametes very, very rapidly, if you don't have to do a lot to raise the growing embryo, you're going to have a low investment in your offspring. You can take risks. You can reproduce a lot, and maybe some of them make it, some of them don't. You see this a lot in species where that practice, they don't have pregnancy, and they can produce enough gametes that if even a small percentage of them survive, the species is fine. In this case, you won't see a favoritism towards family members because they don't have any way of identifying related organisms. If passing on traits is hard, then you have a larger investment in your offspring that's going to shape your society. You're going to need to take care of immature versions of yourself. You're basically going to have to raise them. You're going to have to spend time feeding them. You can't just assume that they're going to be fine and they'll figure themselves out. You need to spend a lot of effort keeping your offspring alive. So this combined with the benefits of keeping related individuals alive, if you're thinking in purely mercenary genetic terms, is part of why we see family-based social structures being so common. It's a very successful way of keeping yourself alive if raising offspring is expensive. And inheritance is also where evolution comes from. If you have genetic variation and you have inheritance of that variation, and some of those variants are more successful than others, the species is going to evolve. Those beneficial alleles will become more common over time. The detrimental alleles will become less common over time. And as we've mentioned, we've tried to interfere with that a few times. That's what genetic engineering is. Evolution is how we got to be what we are today. And considering that we are all the product of billions of years of successful survival, reproduction, overcoming pretty incredible odds, it's something to be proud of. We are survivors, and we are the offspring of survivors, going back as far as life has existed on our respective planets. Interesting side effect of the way inheritance works is you can get genetic parasitism. By this I mean things like viruses or viroids or other similar molecules. This is basically an infectious molecule. The way viruses work is they attach onto a host cell. They inject a piece of genetic material. That genetic material is the cell can't tell the difference between its own genetic material and what was just put into it, and the cell gets hijacked. It starts making viruses rather than doing what it was supposed to do. And this is basically due to flaws in cellular security. Cells can't identify us versus them, it's a molecule, it's a strand of nucleic acids. There's really not a way of marking it. Closest we can see is some Earth bacterial species, for example, have restriction enzymes that will destroy DNA that carries a particular sequence. And since the bacterial sequence is protected against them, it doesn't have that sequence, or those sequences are modified with methyl groups. Only viral sequences will be attacked. This is, you know, it's something, but it's not a failsafe. So, because many species can't tell the difference between self-DNA and foreign DNA, viruses are a persistent health problem. We have yet to find a cell type that doesn't have a virus that infects it. Viruses will compete over territory within cells. And this is all done by what is basically a strand of nucleic acid with some proteins and maybe some carbohydrates or lipids wrapped around it. They are not living. They have no will or no desire. They just persist because it works. Viroids are similar, except they're even simpler. They're only just a piece of nucleic acid, which enters a cell, alters its gene expression, makes copies of itself, and is spread. So these kinds of diseases, or these kinds of environmental threats, are something we're still dealing with despite the state of our medical technology. And I do want to make a point about what a species is, because this is tied to genetic material and inheritance. The definition of species is an interbreeding population of organisms. So if you have two different populations and they're able to interbreed, they're the same species. If they're not, they're different. This ability to interbreed is due to variation, or is due to genetic material. So if the genetic material has become different between the two populations, if they've evolved separately, then they may not be able to produce viable offspring. So if you have two populations, when they try to interbreed, the hybrid is viable, but it can't produce offspring, that's a genetic dead end, and it's a very expensive one, because the parents went through all the trouble of making a baby, and then it's not able to pass on their genetic material any further. So that's not a good idea. And you see a lot of evolutionary mechanisms to prevent this from happening. So everything from mating dances, pheromones, compatible or incompatible genitalia, various ways of making sure that when we pick someone to reproduce with, it's someone where we have a good chance of having healthy offspring. So these are called, we have reproductive isolating mechanisms. So those that happen before a zygote forms are called prezygotic isolating mechanisms. Those that kick in after that zygote is formed, such as hybrid inviability or infertility, are post-reproductive isolating mechanisms. Now, contrary to Earth's fictional past, I'm sure some of your literature classes you've run into cases where they talked about hybrid species between humans and some other alien life form. That doesn't make a lot of sense. If we can't reproduce with other organisms on this planet, we're not going to be able to reproduce with organisms on other planets. So this dashed the hopes of a lot of very romantic humans. You know, we tend to be xenophilic, if anything. But that doesn't mean that, you know, interspecies couples are perfectly normal. They do great. It's just this one aspect isn't favored in terms of genetic inheritance. But I think this is the fact that we kept hoping for it is part of why humans have taken so well to being part of the alliance. I think it says something nice about us as a species that we don't focus so much on genetic inheritance and genetic compatibility, but more on compatibility of spirit. All right, so I went a little off topic at the end, but that's fine. So I just wanted to make a correction on the lecture from last time. I had mentioned the bees on Typhon. There are no bees on Typhon. And if you would be, as always, if you need to see the slides for the presentation or the class notes, they are available on the class website at patreon.com/bekernwrites. And I will see you all next time.
EXO 101 is the property of Brendan E. Kern and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. I tweet at B.E. Kern Writes, and I can be emailed at bekernwrites@gmail.com. The intro and outro music are Brittle Rill by Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com, and are licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license. This and other works can be found at my website, bekernwrites.com. My work is supported by Patreon. You can become a patron at patreon.com/bekernwrites.